You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 83. There is no greater agony than bearing an untold story inside you. Maya Angelou.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft, it's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. And guys, I have a special treat for you. If you are interested in getting a three-part video series on screenwriting and how to write blockbusters in Hollywood today by some Oscar winners, some multi-billion dollar screenwriters, all you got to do is head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/free-video-series. Sign up for it there and you will get three amazing videos, almost an hour in length total, in your inbox. So just head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/free-video-series. Guys, I am super excited to bring you today's episode. We have best-selling author Will Storer and his book, The Science of Storytelling, Why Stories Make Us Human and How to Tell Them Better, is an amazing deep dive into how story affects the brain. And I got to tell you guys, I've done over 500 interviews at this point between all our podcasts in the last few years. And I've talked to some of the greatest story minds, analysts and screenwriters and storytellers on the planet. And it is rare for me to hear a new concept in the world of storytelling. And Will brought that to this episode. His combination of storytelling and science, in the science of the brain and the neuroscience of the brain, is amazing. I was so excited, once I took a look at the book, to have him on the show. And this conversation does not disappoint. If you cannot spark an idea for a story or how to take your character to the next level, I don't know what else I can do. Because as I was talking to Will, story ideas started popping into my head. I'm like, well, if I did this to this character, I did that to that character. It was really a remarkable experience, and I cannot wait to bring this episode to you. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Will Storer. I'd like to welcome to the show Will Storer, man. How are you doing, Will?
I'm good, thank you, Alex. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic, sir. You are on, as they say, the other side of the pond we are recording from. I still love talking to people around the world. It's amazing, our technology.
I know, it's quite amazing. It's incredible, isn't it? Yeah, it's fantastic. I remember when calling the States was like cost a fortune. Every minute you're being charged, $3. It's just free video calls.
Now it's free video calls, and like we take it for granted. And now we're just like, isn't it funny how technology works? It's like once you get it, you assume and you demand it. It's kind of like, why is the connection across the world for free so bad today? Oh God, it's insane. But
it's not good enough.
Yeah. But listen, thank you so much again for being on the show. I'm dying to dig into your book, The Science of Storytelling. And before we do that, how did you get into the business? How did you get into the storytelling business?
Well, so my my background is I'm a journalist, and I do a lot of science, psychology reporting, and I've written books based on psychology. But for longer than I've been a journalist, I wanted to write stories, you know, and fictional stories. So I tried to write a novel when I was like 8 years old. It was obviously terrible. You know, so I always sort of wrestled with that. And then, you know, I did the typical young person thing, young man, young person thing of you know, when you're young, you think, well, you know, I'm an artist. I don't need those books on how to write stories. You've got to be a genius, you know. You go through that phase, and then eventually, when you've failed enough, you go, fuck it, you know, I'm going to do it. So, I was actually researching a book called The Unpersuadables, which is about why clever people believe crazy things. And I was doing that and interviewing, you know, some world famous psychologists and neuroscientists. And at the same time as that, I started reading all these books on storytelling because I was also working on my novel in my spare time. So I was reading The Seven Basic Plots and I read Robert McKee and, you know, all the usual kind of suspects. And I realized that what the kind of storytelling people were saying and what the scientists were saying, there was so many commonalities between them. Like the importance of change, you know, character and character flaw. And I just thought that was really interesting, you know. And so the kind of my nonfiction book, the answer to that, why do clever people believe crazy things, ended up being, well, because the brain's a storyteller. It's not a logic processor. It tells a story. That's what it does. That's its sort of function. And we tend to believe stories that flatter our sense of heroism. And that's why clever people end up believing crazy stuff. And so, you know, I carried on kind of interrogating that for my own kind of fiction work. And that became a course. I started teaching a course at the Guardian newspaper on the science of storytelling. And then that became the book. So it's kind of a weird way around.
Isn't it interesting? Because if you start thinking about it, your whole life is story. Everything we do is story. And it serves not only just like, yeah, sure, we're going to go watch the Avengers and that's nice and everything. But it serves a purpose because if you tell the story, I'm like, Bob went down to the river and around that corner, there was a tiger that ate him. There might be a group of tigers there you might want to stay away from. That story actually helps protect the tribe, if you will, on a very elemental level.
Yeah, absolutely. That's absolutely right. And it's I think the big kind of light bulb on for me was thinking that it isn't that the brain is like a storyteller. It's that stories are like brains. When we write screenplays or write novels, we're mimicking what the brain does. And so as living creatures, we're surrounded by this chaos of confusing information. And the brain has to kind of radically simplify that information. There's a neuroscientist called Chris Frith that says the brain's kind of job is to make you feel like you're the invisible actor at the center of the world. And that's what it does. And what storytellers have been doing through the ages, fictional storytellers, is mimicking those processes. You know the big three acts of archetypal storytelling: crisis, struggle, resolution. That's what happens to us when, you know, in life, when things go wrong. The train is late. And you're going to miss your meeting, or you know, you slip into kind of crisis struggle resolution mode. Your consciousness narrows, and now you're a hero at the center of this story. How am I going to do it? How am I going to get there? And that's what the brain does to help us solve problems, to help us understand the world. And so there's so many. Once you understand that what you're doing when you're writing a screenplay is you're mimicking the way a brain works. Then there are so many kind of things that you can get from science then about how to tell better stories.
So like that example you just gave, which is basically like my train is late and you go into the crisis mode, you know, watching Indiana Jones, that's just a heightened version of that. And obviously, or watching the Avengers or watching, you know, any of these superhero tentpole films, it's just heightened versions of the basic three things that you just talked about.
Yeah, exactly. And if you're a modernist storyteller, like in the book, I talk about a Kafka short story, and that was literally his story. There was a Ghana tram, and he noticed the particular shape of a woman's ear, and it gave him this. I can't remember what the thought was, some profound Kafkaesque thought, and that's the end of the story. You know, so what you've got there is what I think are the minimal conditions for a story, and that's that something happens that changes somebody somewhat. And in a very kind of literary modern story or very art house film, it's quite subtle what changes, but in a great broad blockbuster, it's kind of obvious what changes. You know, the Death Star blows up, you know.
Exactly. Now, can you discuss what the model making brain is?
So this is a really mad idea. Well, it's not even an idea. It's a theory that is known to be true, but this is how the brain works, essentially. And if you don't know this stuff, it's at once really obvious when you think about it, but also really disturbing. And that is that we don't experience reality. Like, we think that our eyes are windows and we're looking out of our windows and we're seeing the world, and the eyes are windows and our ears are these empty tubes into which sounds come. But obviously that's not true. You don't look out of your eyes. Information comes in one way. So how does that work? Well, how that works is that information kind of hits the senses. The senses translate it to millions and millions of electrical pulses. And your brain reads these electrical pulses, a bit like a computer reads a CD-ROM or a DVD, and creates a model of the world. And what you experience is that model of the world. It's not actual reality at all. So you don't have any direct access to the real world. You don't really know what it looks like outside your body. What you're getting is this fake model of the world. And of course, there's lots of debate about how accurate the model we experience is. You know, humans have a certain kind of brain that experiences a certain kind of world. But there are some really fundamental differences, sort of special effects the brain paints onto this model. And one of those special effects is color. So around our bodies, in the real world, there's no color. Everything is monochrome. Atoms don't have color. What happens is that some of that information is in light waves. And depending on the length of the light wave, your brain just goes, well, that's a pink, that's a blue, that's a brown, and it paints it on. So it's really when you talk about the brain being a storyteller, it really is from the ground up a storyteller. It's getting all this chaotic information and it's conjuring this multicolored kind of slightly fake world for you to live in. That is, like Chris Frist says, you know, it puts you in the middle of it, makes you the all important actor at the center of it. So that's that kind of basic idea of, and that's kind of what that's how storytelling works on a very basic level. So your brain doesn't care where it's getting information from. It can be getting information from words on a page of a novel, or from a cinema screen, or from a computer screen. As long as it's giving it model information to build a model with, it's going to build that model. So that's why when you say to somebody, don't imagine an elephant, they imagine an elephant, because your brain is just constantly making models. So that's what filmmakers are doing. They're giving brains information with which to kind of build models of imaginary worlds.
So that's why a good writer who can use the language like an artisan can conjure up those images in your head so much better. And that's what kind of, not only on the craft standpoint, but just on the not on the plotting standpoint and character standpoint, but just literally using being a wordsmith. You know, you read a Shane Black screenplay, and the way he describes a rainy alley, it's not like the alley was dark and rainy. No. You when he writes it, you smell it, you taste it, and that is what that conjures those images in your head. So that's why that screenplay probably was sold for a couple $1 million.
Yeah, and that's right. You know, when you say you smell it and taste it, that is almost literally true. So when you put people in brain scanners and they read about kind of the furry fuzz of a peach skin, areas involved in touch light up in their brain. So that is really literally true. It's building a model of that furry touch, and that's why. You know, that's why, you know, the best writing, it has that absolute clarity. You know, it's kind of simplicity, but kind of packed with kind of meaning, sensory meaning, you know. And when I write about dialogue, I think that's one of the keys to really great dialogue. When you look at really great dialogue, it has that clarity, but it's packed with information about who the character is, about where they're going, what they're doing, what the power dynamics are in the room. You know, in great dialogue, you can read the first page of an Arthur Miller play and know within the first two pages exactly where the story is going, exactly who the characters are, because that dialogue is packed with so much information that the model making brain can then use to create this world, and it's all unconscious, so it's just doing it all the time, and so I think that's the key to that that really great dialogue writing.
So that's kind of why, you know, for writers, it's not just, you know, originally it was the novel, you know, and or with the cave painting, if you want to get real technical. But, you know, the novel, then films, television, now video games have arguably overtaken cinema as a way for people to completely fall into a world, and especially those role playing RPGs where you're just walking around and they're literally creating the world with you. And you want to talk about stimulation? You put that, you put the earphones on. You put the, you, if you want to get into the VR mode, you're completely gone. You are in.
Yeah, that's it. Because it's taking away the sensory information from the actual world and replacing it with different stuff. And it's like a movie, but you are literally the invisible actor at the center of that world. So, and that's why they wonder why people get addicted to those video games and end up spending hours and hours and hours and days playing them, all because, you know, they are, you know, creating much more incredible and interesting and emotional worlds for people to live in than their real world. So of course they get addicted to them.
It's kind of like, you know, from what we've been talking about so far, the Matrix does not sound very outlandish. I mean, I've always said the Matrix is a documentary personally. I mean, a lot of this stuff, you know, on a subconscious level, but like the Matrix, you know, you arguably could, maybe in our lifetime, maybe a couple hundred years from now, who knows, but you could eventually be able to just plug in to a computer and connect and download and upload. I mean, it sounds crazy now, but it's not that crazy.
No, well, I mean, the brain is a virtual reality machine. That's literally what it is. It's not a reality machine. It's a virtual reality machine. It creates this virtual story world and suspends you in the middle of it and fills it full of drama and, you know, emotion. And everyone's got, you know, if you're psychologically healthy, you've got goals you're trying to pursue and you're engaged in the kind of emotional ups and downs of the pursuit of those goals. That's a story. That's a screenplay, you know. And that's why when we're watching a great movie, it feels so engaging and evolving. It's just a very heightened life. It's a heightened kind of human consciousness that is kind of easy to kind of tumble into.
Yeah, and that works with cinema. That works with, you know, television. That works with video games. That works with a novel. I mean, I remember when I first read Harry Potter, my mind was I was like, what is this literary crack? I was just completely enthralled. Or you read a Stephen King novel or something like, you're just good writing. You're just in and it grabs you.
That's it. And I think one of the sort of big takeaways I got from the science was the importance of, you know, cause and effect in those big blockbusters and the great sort of best-selling novels. You know, cause and effect is a really fundamental way that human brains understand the world, and that kind of separates us from other animals. So there's one study they did where they compared the behavior of chimpanzees, who are one of our closest relatives, to human children. And they gave them the task of like stacking up these wooden blocks on their ends. But the wooden blocks had a lead weight kind of buried in them in a weird place, so they keep falling over. And what you find is that the chimpanzees just keep trying to stack the blocks and they keep falling over and they just keep at it and then they get bored. Whereas the human children, they're pre-verbal children. They start picking up the blocks and looking at them. They're asking, you know, what caused that? What's the cause of that? So it's that cause and effect. So, you know, we understand the world in causes and effects. That's what, you know, as soon as there's sort of unexpected change in our environment, it triggers our response, you know, we look at it, it gets our attention, and then we immediately ask, well, you know, what caused that and what's going to happen next? And so really, really well written, you know, screenplays for blockbusters are very clear in their causes and effects. You know, it's very, and that's what makes it kind of effortless to be engaged in the movie, because cause and effect is the natural language of the brain. Whereas difficult movies, art house movies, you know, literary novels, the cause and effect breaks down. It's quite hard to understand. First, you're being shown this, and then there's this, and who's this person? And hang on a minute, why is it now 1973? You know, and the reason that you know, art house movies are often called dreamlike, and they're called dreamlike because the cause and effect breaks down. It does in dreams, you know, and in novels, literary novels are often called it's hard work, and it's hard work because you're having to do the cognitive effort of working out how one thing connects with the other. And then you have all your arguments with your friends. Well, I think what the author really meant by the, you know, the haunted acorn in the prairie was this. And you have all these arguments. But you don't really get those arguments about Star Wars or Harry Potter because the causes and effects are really clear. One thing leads to the next, which leads to the next. And actually, it sounds easy, but as I'm sure lots of your viewers know, in practice, adhering to that cause and effect is actually quite difficult. You know, having one thing then lead to the next, then lead to the next, then lead to the next. It's quite difficult to write that. It's not as easy as it.
You could do one or two. Yeah, you could do one or two of those cause and effects, but actually to string along a coherent cause and effect that moves the story along is great. That's actually fascinating because I've really never thought about that. Because like when you watch 2001, well, that's a dream. There is no. If you start thinking, like, there's really no cause and effect. There's some slight cause and effect with Hal, with Hal and what Hal's doing, but it's so minuscule compared to Star Wars, which is so concrete as far as
absolutely. This leads to that, 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 and it's just relentless. You know, it doesn't let up, and you're glued to it, and it's that effortlessness, and it's effortless because, as I said, that's the language of the brain. The brain speaks the language of cause and effect, and if you don't give it that. You're gonna have to start using, not your unconscious brain, but your front brain, your thinking brain. So what the fuck's going on,
And that's why, and that's why a lot of times when you see, some of the masters like Kubrick, a lot of his films were misunderstood when they come out, and it takes years for people to catch up to what he was trying to say in his stories. And then there's like deeper levels, and it's like the Matrix has such a deep. It's like such a deep onion. There's so many layers to it. But if you just want to see the cause of effect of a really cool action movie, it's there. But as you,
well, that's the genius of the Matrix. He manages to pull off both tricks, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's not it's Star Wars, but Star Wars with like an insane amount of depth, and you can. So you could arguably have those art house conversations about the Matrix. And also have the did you see that action sequence? Conversation.
And I, those are my favorite stories. I love those kinds of stories that because you can have your cake and eat it. I think in a sense, you can have a great cause and effect, action packed film or novel that's really thoughtful and profound. I mean, my favorite novel and one of my favorite movies is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just brilliant. I mean, it is just. It's a relentlessly efficient plot. It's absolutely. It doesn't sag much. It sags a little bit in the kind of the fourth act, but it's relentlessly entertaining. But it's completely emotional. But it's also really thoughtful and profound and symbolic, and it does all those kind of things that make it that kind of elevate it really into the art space, as far as I'm concerned. So that's my kind of sweet spot. And, we don't get movies so much like that coming out of Hollywood these days. It seems to me.
No, because Hollywood hasn't been in the movie business for quite some time. They're in a selling other stuff business. They're not.
Well, it's kids stuff.
Yeah, exactly. That's what they do. It's not that where we're finding those stories is now TV streaming, series. Okay. You watch Ozarks, you watch Breaking Bad, you watch Game of Thrones. That's where you're looking for that kind of storytelling.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah,
there's no $300 million, and arguably you can't tell it to a $300 million movie. That's a little bit risky. You can't. I get it. It's a business. On a story standpoint. Now, you also talked about the domesticated brain. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So this is a really, again, really sort of critical kind of underlying idea behind the science of storytelling. And that's really the question of why do we tell stories in the first place? Why did we evolve to kind of tell stories? And so to understand that, you've got to understand a bit about human evolution. And so, we were animals. We still are animals, technically. But when we were kind of
some more than others in this world.
When we kind of came down from the trees and started hanging out around campfires, we started existing much more in groups. Tribes of humans, and so that kind of. We used to like apes settle our problems by fighting and ripping each other's arms off and all this, you know, violence basically. But when you're living in groups, you can't really do that. You have to learn to have to kind of get on in better ways. So we evolved to be much more collegiate, peaceful, and we domesticated. We went through the same kinds of changes that the wolf went through to become the domesticated dog. We became much more peaceful, much more kind of socially aware, much more emotionally intelligent. And we started talking to each other. And so for a long time, it was thought that we evolved language to kind of strategize, to hunt. But now the kind of dominant theory in psychology is that we actually evolved language in order to gossip. And that just seems like a mad thing. Because, well, that's crazy. That's such a stupid thing to say. But actually, it makes perfect sense because humans are now like humans were then. We haven't changed that much. You know, we can be amazing and wonderful and kind, but we're also quite selfish. We tend to put our own interests first. So you have to kind of manipulate people such, control people such, without a police force or a judiciary or an army or a government, that they're going to put the tribe first and they're not going to steal the meat. They're not going to rip people off. They're not going to attack people. So how do you do that? You do it with gossip. You start telling stories about each other. So if the gossip about you in the tribe is that you're a selfish, aggressive person, you're going to get a bad reputation. And the punishment of that is potentially lethal. Ultimately, you'd be
ostracized.
Was once universal. So the ultimate sanction was obviously death. But before that, you're humiliated, ostracized, you could be kicked out of the tribe, which is also kind of death. So that's how we control each other, with stories, with gossipy stories. And you want to hope that people are telling heroic stories about you. And then that's how you kind of start transmitting the kind of moral rules of the tribe. So, you know, you find out when you're growing up as a child, how do I behave in such a way that I'm celebrated and I become a hero? You learn that through gossipy stories. Oh, you wouldn't believe it. You know, this person was so courageous on the hunt. You know, there was a thing, a saber-toothed tiger was coming at him and he got in the way and, oh, it's amazing. So you learn, oh my God, that's how you become a hero. And equally, you've got to learn how to not be kicked out of the tribe, how to not be killed. And that's, again, through gossip. So that's why gossip is so fundamental to the human experience. It's so fundamental to our evolutionary history. And it's at the basis of all our stories. And you think about any story that's kind of successful, it's basically based on gossip. You know, whether it's a story in the National Enquirer or it's Anna Karenina, it's basically, you never believe what happened.
It's the Iliad.
It's usually stories, especially if they're sort of, you know, big screenplays or big best-selling novels, they're completely morally infused. You know, it's full of heroes doing morally good things. And very often at the end of the story, when they really prove their heroism, they put the tribe's interests before their own, and that's how you identify them as the hero. They finally bust through their own self-interest and blow up the Death Star, you know. So gossip is fundamental to our evolution. It's fundamental to we couldn't survive in society without gossip, and it's always there in successful stories in some way.
Yeah, I mean, even within the stories, the characters gossip about the other characters.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you watch Shawshank Redemption, which is one of my favorite films, they're constantly talking about, oh, there's that quiet guy, Andy.
Yeah.
Well, what's he?
And that's how we learn about people in real life and in story is through gossip. But I think gossip's a universal. When we think about gossip, we think, oh, it's a terrible thing that people do and they shouldn't do it. But everybody does it. It's a universal. It's cross-cultural. It crosses the genders. Men and women gossip just as much as each other. But the scientists find that men gossip less when women are present. So when it's just guys, we're just as bad as the women.
Oh, no, it's absolutely.
Pretend that we don't do it, you know.
Absolutely true. When the dudes get together, when the boys are together, we're like, did you see what that dude did?
Yeah, exactly.
Or then you gossip about what the football game you saw the day before. Yeah. Like, did you see what Beckham did? Did you see what, you know?
Yeah, it is a form of gossip because it's this moral judgment. They were terrible. They didn't do this thing. Didn't pass the ball or whatever it is. Yeah, it's gossip, gossip, gossip. It infuses our lives. And if you think about it that way, if language evolved to enable us to gossip, then the first stories, the original stories, was gossip. And again, I think that's a really sort of powerful insight for me about storytelling. When you read about the psychologists, when they investigate gossip, that, you know, they talk about how it works. And most gossip is about moral infractions. We're not that interested in gossip about people being amazing. We much prefer gossip about people being sort of dangerous.
Well, obviously, National Enquirer is kind of like the bad stuff.
That's valuable intelligence. It's much more important that we learn who's the threat, because
interesting.
So you hear that gossipy story, and you experience a very specific emotion, and that emotion is moral outrage. And moral outrage is interesting because it compels you to act. It compels you to want to punish the transgressor, to rescue the person that they're there attacking. You know, you feel like you want to act. But of course, if you're watching a movie, you can't act. So what you do is you keep watching. You're kind of glued to the screen. You keep watching, and then when Darth Vader gets his comeuppance, it's just this amazing emotional release. And when you feel that amazing emotional release, that's your tribal, you know, survival circuitry being manipulated by the storyteller. And that was all evolved tens of thousands of years ago when we were kind of learning how to live cooperatively in tribes.
And I think that's one of the reasons the success of the Marvel Cinematic Universe is that they took a decade to build that tension up to the point where in the end game they finally to defeat Thanos. It's a masterwork. And I've watched the video on YouTube, like the crowd reaction with if anybody hasn't seen Endgame, spoiler alert, when everything's down, Captain America's down, you know, Thor and Iron Man, and then all of a sudden everybody shows up at one time to fight Thanos. It was like this roar and just like this amazing, look, I'm getting goosebumps just talking about it.
I'm listening to you talking about it, but that, take it seriously, because those goosebumps, that's your evolution, you know.
Yeah.
When your tribe arrives en masse to fight the enemy,
right,
you've evolved to have those goosebumps and to want to go yes, because that's how we survive.
That's amazing. That's so, like, I knew we were gonna poke the bear in this episode, and this is awesome, because I love talking about neuroscience and specifically.
But it's a practical thing too, because, you know, often when I'm teaching storytelling and especially when I'm getting the novelists who are wanting to write this kind of high literature stuff, and you say to them, well, where's the moral outrage in your premise? You know, why? You know, it's really important. If your moral outrage is such a powerful thing to get people glued into a story, as soon as you're experiencing a story and you experience moral outrage on behalf of a character, you're in. You care about them. That's, you know, it's working. But if there's no sense of, oh my God, that's not fair, it's very hard to understand, well, where's the, how are you making people care about your character? Or this situation, if there's no, and moral outrage, it doesn't have to be directed at a human being, as is right in the book, in John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. The moral outrage, you know, it's set in the Dust Bowl, and there's a drought, and the family are pushed out of Oklahoma, and you feel moral outrage on their behalf against the weather. You know, it can be that, but as long as, you know, but you feel like, oh my God, it's not fair. They're an amazing, the Clutters, they're such a hardworking family, and look what's happened to them. Oh my God, I hope they survive. And as soon as you start feeling those things, you're in. You know, he's got you.
Well, the easiest way to, I mean, this is an old technique, but the easiest way to make a villain villainous is, well, have him kick the dog.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you have the bad guy kick the dog, it's done. Like, he's got to go.
And that's it. And it's one of those things, you know, because I'm interested in storytelling, but I'm also reading all these science books. I have this experience of, you know, reading these science books, and they say stuff like that, and you think, oh my God, that's just like story. And one of them is that when they do surveys of the contents of gossip in hunter-gatherer tribes that exist, they say that most of it is about moral transgressions by high-status people. You know, big shot behavior, you know, unpleasant kind of big shot behavior. And you think, well, that's story. You know, that's so many stories are kind of focused. You know, the enemy is a high status person who does something bad towards a low status individual or a dog.
Right, because,
you know, that's just imbues modern storytelling, and it is all the way back in our gossip that we used to tell.
Because a lot of times we are, unless you're the king, you are. Yeah. On a lower standpoint. So you identify much more with the dog than you do with the king, generally speaking.
Because we were never the king, you know. And also that's the other interesting thing about human groups is like chimpanzee groups. Is that you know, when we're evolving, there was never really a king. Human groups are always relatively leaderless. So it was the group that's always in charge, and the group is cohering with these kind of gossipy stories, and you get these awful kind of terrifying accounts in the ethnographic literature of, you know, some poor bastard is, you know, there was one I read recently where some woman died of what we would know is a disease, but in Papua New Guinea they didn't know it was a disease. They decided that it was an act of malicious sorcery, and so the sorcerer does this magic ritual with some leaves and some burning leaves, and decides this guy did it. And this guy's going, fuck, you know. And within days they went around gossiping behind his back, and consensus built they had to be dealt with, and he was killed and eaten. And you think,
well,
there's hell.
Well, there's that.
Yeah, but that's how terrifying it was. I mean, you know, so you know, that's gossip. You know, these days gossip, I mean, on social media, gossip can be pretty lethal for someone's careers these days. You know, we're getting back to that. People aren't being killed and eaten quite, but you see the power of gossip in human communities. It's a lethally dangerous thing. It's a very powerful thing, gossip.
And then social media has heightened all of that, because now our tribe is the world. Yeah. And if you do something, or you know, a video comes out, or you say something that you're not supposed to, they pull something out from 20 years ago that you tweeted about or something, and your whole life gets thrown upside down. We've seen careers.
Yeah, ostracization. It's the same. All the stuff that happens, cancel culture online, is just us being tribal, as we have been for tens of thousands of years. The reason that all those, you know, social media platforms work is because we're tribal. You know, we've got the follower accounts, we've got the status updates. You know, it's all tribal, and it's all working on this on this very dangerous, very addictive, very compulsive, very emotional tribal neural architecture. And you know, cancel culture is just tribal ostracization. You know, it's what we've been doing at our worst for tens of thousands of years. So.
Yeah, I know. Let's not get into social media, because that's a whole other conversation.
can
you talk about the differences between the Western stories versus Eastern stories?
Yeah. So this is something that came up in actually, I wrote a book about social media, and it came up in there, and I just thought this was kind of fascinating. So as lots of people surely know, one of the big cultural differences between East and West is the East. In the West, we're much more individualistic. Mm-hmm. In the East, generally speaking, it's more communitarian. And there are various ideas about how this came to be. But you know, one of the ideas is that it all stems from ancient Greece. We are naturally groupish. We are naturally thinking groups. But in the West, we had this. In ancient Greece, there was this weird kind of landscape. We were living in little islands and little communities. We couldn't farm because the soil was so bad, and we were forced to kind of survive on our own. You know, we couldn't survive. In China, they had massive rice-growing communities and irrigation projects. Yeah, so they had. So to survive in China, you had to be part of a group. The group had to be working as one. In the West, you had to stand on your own 2 feet. So out of ancient Greece comes modern European culture, you know, self-love, narcissism, the word narcissism, for God's sake, comes from ancient Greece. And that still kind of directs the differences in how we see the world. And it also directs the differences in the kind of ways that we tell our stories. So for the Westerner, change is essentially down to the individual. We have the individual hero. Problems strike the world. The individual hero rises up like a Greek god, fights the monsters, and comes back with all the boons and whatever, where else, and learns the truth of the story. But in East Asia, they don't have stories. But they have other kinds of stories. They don't tend to tell those kinds of stories because they don't see change as being the role of the individual. They see change as being kind of the role of the group. And so what you get in China is kind of these kinds of stories that we find difficult to process as Westerners, because for us, they don't have any endings, for example. So one of them, they have four act stories. And in act one, change happens to somebody. In act two, It just carries on for a bit. Act three, you're taken somewhere else to a completely different place, different context, different time, different person. Then act four, you're back to the first person again, and then it ends. And you're left as the viewer, the reader, to work out how do all these different disparate elements kind of achieve harmony? And so when I interviewed a psychologist from South Korea, he said, you know, you Westerners don't understand these stories because you want an ending. You want the hero to come back with having learned the thing, and you want to be told what the truth is. But in the East, you know, we understand that change is that you know, change is kind of a part is the function of the group, and that your job is to work out how these kind of disparate elements can achieve harmony and how both of these things can be true at the same time. So it's a very different way of kind of telling stories. It's a very different way of understanding the world. I could go on and on about it, but I won't. But it was very interesting to me how. The crisis struggle resolution thing is particularly a Western model. One of the sort of quick takeaways I found was extraordinary was that in China they didn't even have autobiography until very recently. So for us in the West, who we think of individuals and individual heroes, what could be more obvious than telling the story of a hero? You know, you would do that. It's an obvious thing to do. But autobiographies never really came about in China until relatively recently, and when they did come about. The kind of subject of the autobiography wasn't in the middle of all the action. They're in the periphery of the action, kind of looking on at their lives, kind of commenting on it. So, yeah, really different ways of telling stories.
Now, why do you think, though, that American culture and individualistic culture, specifically the American culture, has completely invaded the rest of the world and has been so accepted? So our movies, our music, our culture, you know, even from, I would probably argue since the 70s and 80s, it's when it started to be, our number one export is our culture, which is extremely, you know, individual. It's all about me. It's about the champ, you know, it's about, look, it's Rambo, it's Rocky, it's, you know, it's Stallone, it's Schwarzenegger back in the 80s and 90s, like these bigger than life, you know, heroes that, you know, took it all on themselves. Why is that so popular in Eastern cultures? And how did that even become a thing?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I haven't really thought about that in that way before, but my immediate response would be that of course, you know, the 20th century was the American century. And, you know, at one point, culture was all coming from Italy, and then it was coming from the UK.
Yeah.
And now it's America's turn because you're now the Western superpower. And, you know, whereas everybody once looked to Italy or us in the UK or, you know, England, and now they look to you, I think there's that going on. But I also think that I think the success of American culture in the East is a product of the fact that kind of these individualistic values are now spreading around the world. So, you know, individualism from ancient Greece through to Italy, through Western Europe, and then to America, from individualism, you get the Enlightenment, you get the invention of human rights, you get capitalism. So basically modernity is this kind of and individualism are very, very kind of tightly bound, and of course that's going to spread around the world now. So I think wherever you get capitalism and capitalistic values, you're going to get individualistic values too. One of the places that I wrote about in my book Selfie was about South Korea, because South Korea is really interesting because it's the most westernized Asian country.
Yeah. Right.
So you know, it's mix between Western values, but they've still got the Confucian values about family and group too. And what you also get in South Korea is like unbelievably high suicide rates. You know, the pressures on young people in South Korea are just so high, because in the individualistic West we kind of tend to feel like we have to please ourselves. In the East, they have to please their group and their parents. In South Korea, they have to please everyone, and it's just a nightmare. But of course, in South Korea, you do get, you know, those Western films, Western music is also really big in South Korea. So I think that yeah, wherever you get those Western values of kind of capitalism, and you're gonna find a kind of good ground for Western art too.
Right, because I mean, you look at a country like India, which is obviously an Eastern country. You know, Bollywood they make much more films, many more films. Their industry is so much larger than Hollywood, but yet it doesn't travel.
It
doesn't travel. Like Bollywood films, you know, they don't do much business here at all, because they're very specific in this kind of storytelling they have. Though I don't know if you've seen some of the visual effects are fantastic, and some of the stuff that goes on in some of these action Bollywood films, you're just like, this is awesome, because they're so outlandish. But they don't travel. But yet our stories, and it's not just about budget and about visual effects and that kind of stuff, because other countries have that now, China and India and other countries. I think those stories, that's the question I have. It's like, why have our stories been able to travel into these tribes that historically don't like these kind of stories, or are not grown with, or maybe it taps into something that is inherent in all of us as our ego inside needs individualism.
Because again, I'm thinking about, you know, before Hollywood, there was like Charles Dickens and, you know, Shakespeare.
Sure.
And of course, yeah, you know, the storytellers.
The Iliad, things like that, yeah.
Yeah, also, you know, in ancient Greece, those stories, of travel around the world. And I was also thinking about, I forget what the tribe's name is, but there was a tribe where they have hardly any language, and so there was a theory that this was a human tribe that didn't have storytelling. And so what the researchers did was they took a DVD of the reboot of King Kong and showed the tribe this DVD of King Kong, and they said they went mad. They loved it. You know, they were cheering all the right places, running around in fear, you know. So it is.
Really? Saying,
you know, I think what it's difficult for me to say, because what from Shakespeare to Dickens to Hollywood today does is tap into very universal kind of ideas that seem to be able to travel in such a way. But yeah, it's a good question. You know, if you want to know why stories from India and China don't travel so well in the other direction, perhaps it's because, at least over the period of history we're talking about, it's Western culture that's gone out around the world rather than the other way around. And maybe, you know, in the future, maybe that'll flip. Maybe in a couple of hundred years, it'll be Chinese stories we're all into. And
who knows what's going to happen. Yeah. You're very optimistic. 100 years, you're very optimistic with what's going on in the world. I hope there is another
long.
I hope there's a long tail, sir, to the human race. I really do. Now, can we discuss a little bit about the flawed self and how that translates into storytelling?
Yeah. This is for me, probably the most important kind of thing that I've kind of worked out as I'm teaching this stuff. And that's that if there's one problem that storytellers have, whether they're writing screenplays or novels or whatever, is that they've got their plot and they've got their characters and they're not connected. You know, usually they've got a great idea for a plot. They say, well, what if this happened and this happened? And I say to them, well, you know, tell me about your story. Then they give me this sequence of events. And I say, well, tell me about the character, the protagonist. And they go, oh. And then you say, well, look, how do you know that's the sequence of events if you don't know who your character is? Because your character is deciding those sequence of events. So I suppose that, you know, it always goes back to the same thing, which is a story is a self. You know, when you're writing a story, you're recreating true reality that comes from a true, real person. And if you think about yourself as a story, you are a particular character with a particular background, a particular selection of flaws and problems. And you have a goal, and that goal comes out of who you are, comes out of your background, your values, your hopes and dreams. It's a product of your character. You also have your flaws, you know, and for all of us who are alive, you know, part of being alive is that you keep making the same mistakes over and over and over again. You know, you keep getting this thing wrong or these things wrong. So those are your kind of obstacles as you go through your life. You know, that's the plot of your life, your goals and your kind of obstacles. And that's how it should be in story too. You know, so you should have a flawed, you know, the plot should come out of who that character is. The plot should come out of that character's flawed idea about the world. And the example that I use is the simplest example. Well, the example that I use in great in depth in the book is The Remains of the Day by Ishiguro, you know, book of award-winning novel. And so, you know, that's about this guy Stevens, who is a English butler, and his kind of flawed idea of the world, his complete kind of conception of how the world works, is that England and the English are the best, and everyone else are idiots. And if you want to be a good proper English butler, you have to exercise emotional restraint. So it's really an interrogation of that old idea of the English upper lip. You know, it's like stoicism, strength. Anybody who doesn't do that is an idiot. So the story that Ishiguro tells around Stevens is that, you know, he hasn't placed Stevens' story at the heart of the British Empire, heart of British power, in, say, 1880. He's put it in 1950, when the decline of British power is beginning to be in full swing. The aristocrat that he used to serve is now long gone, and there's an American dude who now he has to serve in his mansion. But the American's really friendly and like jokes with him, and he like talks to him on a level, and he can't cope with it. He can't deal with it. So all of the things that he's having to deal with in his life are challenging that idea of English supremacy, of the English stiff upper lip, and the story of Lorenzo is him trying to cope with that. And so that whole story comes out of his floor. It comes out of his character. And a much simpler example from the world of sort of blockbuster movies is Jaws. You know, you think about Jaws. What's Jaws? Oh, it's a movie about a killer shark. And yes, of course, it's a movie about a killer shark. But that movie is structured around a flawed self with a particular flaw that he has to struggle with. And that is that Brody, this police chief, who has just recently been put in charge of the, you know, coastal resort town of Amityville, is scared of the water. Like, he's really scared of the water. When he gets the ferry across from the mainland, he can't even get out of his car. He's so scared of the water. And so the shark comes along, and what that means is that he has to wrestle with his flaw. He can't carry on being scared of the water anymore. He's either got to go out there and deal with this thing, or it's over for him. So the shark kind of pulls him out, and then you know, so at the exact midpoint of the movie, he goes out to the, you know, he gets the courage to go out into the water and fight the shark, and act four happens. The shark fights back. He decides he's made a big mistake and he wants to go back to shore, but he can't. And then finally, the great denouement, he kills the shark. And it, as he's swimming back to shore with his oceanographer mate, the very last thing that you see in the movie is him saying, "I used to be scared of water. I can't imagine why." So you see this great character change. So even a film like Jaws, you know, when I first wrote the book and was teaching this stuff, people used to say to me, "Oh, well, that's true. All this stuff you say about the flawed character in very literary novels and very art house, like, you know, intelligent films, but it's not really true in action films." And so what it is actually, but it's just not that high in the mix, you know, yeah. But it's definitely, but it's there, you know, so that's that. It's that if the plot needs to come out of the character, and it needs to be interrogating that character's flaw and changing it, I think.
Isn't what you just said with Jaws, that's essentially life. You know, you meet people along the way that will challenge your flaw.
Yeah.
Will challenge, like, yeah. if you're afraid to stand up for yourself, I promise you, you will meet a bully.
Yeah. And how I think about it is that most of us go through our lives and things are generally okay, but often, you know, something will happen to us that will specifically trigger us, and we'll flip out and get really emotional, and people go, "Oh, fucking hell, you know, that's your flaw. That's your kind of right. Sacred flaw that I want to hear a story about." Because, you know, so, and that's what happens in lots of the great stories. It's that kind of ignition, the change that happens at the beginning of the story, which ignites the story, connects specifically with somebody's flaw. In Jaws, you can't be scared of the water anymore. In The Remains of the Day, you think the English are so fucking great. Check out this American boss, and check out, you know, the decline of English power in the world. You know, so that to me is you know, one of these things that is really often missed. Even in stories that get made, you get the sense that they've come up with this brilliant idea for a story, but they've just got this cut out and keep, vaguely good looking politically correct people to do the story. And for me, it's not good enough. You know, you can sense when it's there, you know, the kind of propulsion of the story and the originality of the story and the thing that's making it not an exercise in, you know, color by numbers is that it's coming out of a character with a very specific flaw. And in the book, I won't do it now because it takes a while, but in the book I use the example of Lawrence of Arabia talking, because, you know, that's a great example of, that's all about this one guy's particular flaw, and it's both completely absorbing, emotional, but also really original. Like, you just don't know what's going to happen next.
Right. And in Lawrence of Arabia, you literally have him completely beautifully dressed at the beginning in his whites, everything. Yes. And he looks polished and he looks great. Yeah, yeah. And at the end, it's torn apart. He's got blood on him. Visually see the difference between how that character changed. And that's one of the brilliant things about that film. But you see that in a lot. And, you know, it's kind of like when you see that fresh recruit, that fresh private come off the plane to go to war. And as he's going into war, you see the guys have been in there for a year going out, and you see the difference in their faces and their expressions and their look and what they've happened to them. And that's life.
Yeah.
that's story.
And, you know, when you're doing the war movie, you know, like what kind of a person is war going to change? And the thing about Lawrence is that you see him at the beginning of the movie and he's really cocky, arrogant, anti-authoritarian. And he's a bit of a prat, you know. You come across him at work and you think, oh, that guy's a real dick, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You drop that dude in a war zone and you see what happens. You know, he becomes a monster because, you know, he keeps being this rebel and he keeps thinking he's above everybody else, and it turns him into a monster. And, you know, and it has that amazing transformation at the beginning where he's berating somebody else for being a barbarous murderer, and by the end they flipped, and now that person who is berating him for being a barbarous murderer. I mean, it's this perfect, you know, it's perfectly done in that movie.
Now, can you talk a little bit about the God moment?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that in archetypal storytelling, you know, what happens, you've got this flawed character, and something happens to them which kind of challenges that flaw, which forces them to deal with that flaw. You know, that Brody, you can't be scared of the water. You've got to choose now. Are you going to be scared of the water, or are you going to, you know, deal with your fears? And so, of course, when that happens, they lose all control over their lives and their situation. And the more they fight, the more they struggle, the more they lose control. And what you see, and that kind of loss of control happens on both the kind of levels of story. It happens on the level of the external drama, sharks out there killing everybody, but it also happens on the interior psychological world of the protagonist. You know, they're struggling with who they are. Fucking hell, who am I going to be now? Am I going to be, you know, is Stevens in Remains of the Day going to be somebody who is actually emotionally warm and can tell people he loves them and cares for them and isn't just a cold bastard? Or is he going to carry on being a cold English, you know, unemotional bastard? You know, what are you going to do? And so, and what you see at the end of story, archetypal storytelling, is that they finally get control over both of those kind of elements of story in one kind of perfect moment. They get control over the exterior world of the drama and the interior world of who they are. I mean, the obvious example is Star Wars, where Luke uses the Force to, you know, get control over and blow up the Death Star, but he also has the courage and becomes that hero. And so, and it's almost like a fleeting moment. And I call it the God moment because that's the archetypal, you know, who's the hero of the greatest story ever told? It's God. You know, religion is the most powerful story ever told. It obsesses billions of people around the world. And, you know, God's defining characteristic is control. And if you think about it in its broadest terms, that's what we're all seeking. That's what brains want. They want control over the world. Because if we have control over the world and ourselves, we get what we want. So we're always trying to seek control. We're always trying to work out how to get control. And that feeling of having control is kind of blissful. And you know, that's what we see. And that's very often we see the kind of dramatic climax of archetypal stories is that wonderful moment. It's like at the end of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest when Chief picks up the concrete control panel, throws it through the window of the mental institution and jumps, you know, runs out into the moonlight. Like the story doesn't end 10 minutes later when he's having a piss behind the tree, or like a, you know, 2 days later when he's arrested and sent back. It ends at that moment because that's his God moment. That's that beautiful moment where he finally, you know, got control over his flaw.
And he it's almost a self-realization in that yeah. moment, in that small moment of whatever that is. It's like, I got this. I realize what's going on. And you were saying about people wanting to take control because they get things. I mean, there's few people in the world that might take that a little extreme. some of the worst human beings in history have taken the up degree.
Yeah. Well, I mean, really, I was thinking about the Darwinian thing, survival and reproduction. You know, fundamentally, what all living things want to do is work out how to survive and reproduce. How do we do that? And in human groups, we live in social tribes. It's about working out what are the rules. How do I behave in order to be seen as a hero and get status? Because if we get status in life, we tend to get rewards. And that's the same as kind of for any animal. So, you know, very often in this archetypal storytelling, the God moment comes when they have an act of kind of pro-tribe selflessness. Just like, you know, Luke Skywalker risking his life for the good of the rebels.
So, but why, I have to ask you this though, why is breaking away from the tribe, or at least putting the tribe ahead of your needs, looked upon as, I'm explaining it to myself. I'm actually answering myself because you're looking like that. Like, why is that being held up to a higher standard where, when it really is about the tribe and being working with the tribe, as opposed to being that individual who goes out and breaks the rules, and I guess it's the sacrificial part of them. Like, oh, they're so great because they sacrifice themselves for the better of the group.
Yeah. So I think the basic idea is that most of us are pretty selfish, and most of us are looking out for ourselves. And so you kind of need to be bribed in order to put them first. And so part of that bribe is, that's what heroes do. And when you do that heroic thing, everyone's going to tell you you're amazing, and we're going to give you all these gifts of attention. And, you know, and really, when they do studies of status in hunter-gatherer tribes, they find the higher status individuals have better access to better mates. So they get their choice of sleeping partners. They get better access to the better food. They get safer sleeping sites. So there are rewards in human tribes and in all kinds of animal communities for earning status. And in human groups, you're kind of bribed with status, you know, the status of a hero, the status of a loved person, if you do these kind of selfless things. When they look at morality around the world, they find that that's the kind of basis of human morality is selflessness. When you put other people before yourself, no matter where you are in the world, people think that's great and wonderful. And when you put yourself before other people, no matter where you are in the world, people think that's shitty. So and that's, again, that's a tribal thing. It's that kind of, because we're selfish humans, we have to be bribed to act altruistically. And part of that is part of the way that we kind of propagandize that. You know, in the book, I say that the story is tribal propaganda. It's propaganda. It's saying, you know, if you do this, if you have the courage to attack our enemies for us, everyone's going to think you're amazing, and you're going to get to marry her. She's really hot, and you're going to get that steak over there, and everyone's going to say, you know, so that's kind of how it, you know, that's kind of how it works. We have this idea of the hero, and we all try and be, you know, if we're psychologically healthy, we all want to be the hero.
It's very different how history looks at Genghis Khan versus Mother Teresa.
Yeah. That's right. I mean, and that's it. I mean, this isn't sort of part of the book. It's part of my next book, actually. But yeah, there are different ways that humans can earn status. And the three main ones are dominance. So violence, which is what we've been doing since we've been animals. Then there's virtue. So being, you know, virtuous, obviously, but moral. But there's also kind of competence. You can play success games. It's like a chef will earn status by being amazing at something. So you get stories about that stuff too, you know, about somebody becoming the best ice skater ever.
And now, is that one of the reasons why anytime there's a movie, a documentary, a story in regards to telling a story about a person or group that were exceptional at whatever they do. And I'll watch a documentary on like the greatest tennis player, the greatest the greatest chess player, the guy who knows how to paint with his foot, like, whatever, like that's the dude or that's the girl who was able. I'm drawn by those kind of stories. Is yeah. that why those stories, like Rudy? Even in Rudy's not a good example because he wasn't the best. He was obviously sick in the head and really, really wanted to be on this football team. Yeah. God bless
him. But to answer your question, that's absolutely correct. Yeah. In our evolving tribes, you would have punished dominance. So people don't like dominant people. But you would have rewarded virtue and you would have rewarded competence too. So, you know, if you're a great hunter, you raise in status if you know war movies, if you're courageous, you raise in status. So yeah, you know, all these stories that we have about people doing incredible in documentaries, you know, about people doing incredible things.
They're
heroic because it's amazing that you can do that. And that's not a chance thing that humans find that amazing. We find that amazing and thrilling and entertaining because we've evolved to reward that kind of behavior, because that kind of behavior is really useful for the tribe. If you've got this expert who can do something incredible, that's good for everyone. So it's no accident. None of this is accidental. You know, we love to watch that stuff for a reason.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously the examples you gave are actually practical things that people could actually use. But like, I just saw a documentary of the fastest Rubik's Cube solver who happens.
Yeah, me too. I love that. Yeah.
I love that with the cube. I'm fascinated by the subculture in general.
Yeah.
But then like, it's like serious. It's like done. And I'm like, how? Like, and that's.
Yeah.
And you look at some.
That's a good example because there's two things about that. Well, the first thing about that is that you can't take it too literally. So we don't have a part in our brain that makes us think that people who are expert hunters are amazing. It's just expertise. It's just a basic general rule.
Any expertise.
Expertise is great, you know. So, and the second thing about that Rubik's Cube movie in particular was it was full of morality and kind of heroic behavior.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The guy who was the rival of the newcomer was so wonderfully magnanimous.
It was amazing.
I was in tears. You know.
Yes.
And again, that's playing with your tribal emotions. It's that it was this amazingly rare, virtuous display of you're better than me and I love you. You never see that. So no, it's a special film.
No, you watch the Donkey Kong documentary about the guys who are fighting to be the best Donkey Kong player in the world. Yeah, the King of Kong. What an amazing! And that guy, the rival, was the complete prick, and everybody hated him because he was so arrogant. He walked around with a freaking tie and a video and like he had a mullet. It was just such a prick.
Yeah, but that's it again that's trial and error, because you know we hate big shot behavior. If somebody puts them up, if somebody status is earned, the group gives status. If somebody goes in and claims it, we just hate them. Like, you know, I'm a sucker. My guilty pleasure is reality television. I love a bit of reality TV because it's pure gossip, and I'm this show got Below. I think it's a big show in the States, but it's only just come out here called Below Decks.
Oh, I've heard about it.
It's like Downton Abbey on yachts, and every season they have a couple of real pricks who go on there and think they're above everybody else, and you just love hating them. You love hating them, and then they get fired, and you go, yes.
and that's what triggers. That's why reality TV is such a. You know, it's such a heightened reality. It's not reality. It's, you know, I don't think it has been reality for quite some time. But that storytelling aspects, they just tap into our tribal instincts on the good guy, the bad guy, the all that stuff.
And I've got a controversial kind of opinion that I think the reality TV producers are the great unsung heroes of storytelling, because they have to get all this raw material from all these idiots. And they tell, you know, they tell them that they have to make stories with them. And when it works, they do it to spectacular effects. If we have the show in the UK, Love Island, where just a bunch of kids are chucked in a resort.
Yeah, I've seen it.
Have Love Island. And it's just like, you know, they're not the brightest people.
They're pretty. I get it.
And bickering every day. But every single day they build a story, a 45-minute story out of that. And every single day they get millions of viewers. And that to me is a kind of genius.
Well, you watched
that's storytelling.
But if you watched, I mean, did you guys see, you guys saw Tiger King, right?
Oh, That was brilliant. Yeah,
I mean, it's yeah. in such an awe. Like, and I've talked about that on the show before, and please forgive me, everyone listening. But I mean, you watch Tiger King. My wife looked at me like, why are you watching this? I'm like, I can't turn away. This is a train wreck. And as the story continues, you're just like, no, that can't really have happened. No. And like, it just every episode was like, that's not real. How is that?
That's a good example, because one of the things I write in my book is I call it the dramatic question. Mm-hmm. And so the dramatic question is, who is this person? Who are they really? Like, when their back's up against the wall, who are they going to be? And so, you know, are they going to be the flawed version of themselves, or are they going to be the new version of themselves? And so lots of the best drama is when the action is forcing, you know, you come across this idea before, I'm sure, the character to show who they are. And that's true in The Remains of the Day, because you find out more and more about Stevens. He was a bit of an anti-Semite at one point, and you go, oh, God. And then you find out something good he did, and you go, oh. And on that kind of level, The Tiger King was exactly the same as The Remains of the Day, because you were constantly being told new things about who the Tiger King was. And sometimes you were going, oh, he's a hero, he's amazing. And other times you're going, oh, my God, he's a fucking lunatic. He's constantly asking that dramatic question, who is this person? And it played with that dramatic question so well that it just kept you going till the end. I mean, I was always sure Carol was evil, but...
Well, obviously Carol obviously killed her husband and fed her to the tigers.
Yeah.
I mean, Carol Baskin. Obviously there has to be that. But then you watch, like, when you're watching that show, and spoiler alert, one of the handlers, the girl, got her arm torn off by a tiger, and that she was so kind of cool about it.
I know she was. She was heroic.
Like, and then you're starting to think about them. Like, I love her. Like, I can't believe that she would be like, she didn't sue. She didn't bitch. She didn't like, oh my God, this guy's a No, she went back to work like 4 or 5 days later. Like, it was.
And what is that? That is a display of selflessness. She didn't sue. She didn't bitch. She wasn't me. She was like, I'm going to put the tigers, you know, the zoo first.
Yeah.
So that's why she's heroic, because that's the essence of heroism. I mean, she had her arm ripped off, and then
literally
she put herself first. That's another great example of selflessness as heroism.
And then you see him. Like, constantly it's all about me, and he takes the crown, and he's so self-involved. And then the best part about, and then I'll stop talking about Tiger King. The best part about, cause I don't talk to people about Tiger King cause I'm in quarantine, so I don't talk to people about it. But, but the best part was like, when you saw those music videos that he was doing, and you're going, is it me, or is the Tiger King have a decent voice? Like, why? Yeah. He shouldn't sound this good. No. Then we come to find out that it was dubbed and somebody else
singing,
which makes all the sense in the world.
Yeah.
Because I was like, of course he did that. Yeah. Of course. Yeah. He Milli Vanilli'd this. It was so funny.
Yeah. I mean, when they were making, whoever was making that, they must have been just thinking every day, oh my God, this is gold. Like, can you imagine going home every day from that set?
just going like this, I can't. Yeah. But it was also just constructed so beautiful.
It was beautiful.
It was the sixth episode, whatever amount of episode, it was so well constructed.
It was so elegant. It was so brilliantly done. Yeah.
Yeah. Elegant is the only time you'll ever hear the word elegant and Tiger King in the same sentence. Was the craftsmanship.
Netflix are getting so good at those, you know, like from making a Murderer was so brilliantly made as well. I mean, Netflix are actually, we used to be quite proud in the UK of BBC documentaries, but the Netflix have made BBC documentaries look terrible. I mean, you know, like, they're making such brilliant non-fiction films. Netflix, they're kind of leading the world, I think, in
series and stuff like that, in docuseries.
I mean, it's all still very celebrity led out here, you know, send a celebrity on a journey, and God, it feels so dated now.
Yeah, I know. We're known for our celebrities as well here in the States.
I mean, you know, when there's people out there like the Tiger King, and you don't need a celebrity, you know.
Absolutely not.
It's always a celebrity in tears talking about their childhood. It's like, oh God.
I want to ask you one last question about the book. What is the difference between plot as a recipe versus plot as a sympathy for change? Or sympathy of change?
So this is something about you know, I was just talking about how when story analysts in the past have tried to work out how story works, from Aristotle through to Robert McKee and, you know, whoever, they've only had other stories to go by, you know. So Robert McKee, I keep forgetting, he's you know, the hero with a thousand.
That would be Joseph Campbell.
Yeah, of course, Joseph Campbell having a middle-aged moment there. Yeah, in Joseph Campbell, you know, all they have to go on is previous stories. So they get all the previous stories together and they compare them and they go, well, this is what they've got in common. And there's no way of kind of communicating that what they come up with as their solution as a recipe. This thing happens and then this thing happens and then this thing happens and then this thing happens. And that, you know, sometimes that works with Star Wars, with Jaws, but more often than not, it just, when you're watching it, it just feels like it's a recipe. Someone's just followed a recipe. And I think the good thing about starting with the science is that you're starting with something else, and you're not starting with the recipe. And I think one of the kind of basic things about human attention is that we're attracted to change. You know, if there's change in the room, we're just going to look at it. It's how great stories begin. And so, you know, in the book, I talk through various ways you can use traditional plot structure, but in a smarter way with, you know, using it properly with character. But you can also, forget all that stuff and just understand the fact that humans love change. And, you know, really great stories are like a symphony of change. And there's all kinds of different things that can change on it. You know, the character can change. The situation can change, the people around the character can change, the character's goals can change, the character's understandings about the world can change. You know, in really great stories, there's all these changes happening all at once and all these kind of different levels. And at its most kind of abstract, kind of art house level, that's what a story is. It's like, you know, it's stuff changing. And then, you know, of course, the more that you kind of shape that, the more it becomes a kind of archetypal story. So that's what that's about, really. It's about understanding that if you're just following that 22-part monomyth, without really understanding some of this other stuff about kind of character and how people actually work, you risk just following a recipe and coming out with a supermarket cake.
I mean, I know we can talk for at least another 2 or 3 hours about this. I'm fascinated with your point of view on story because it comes from science. And it's a different starting place. This is not theory. This is like, okay, how do we tell? And this is what Hitchcock said years ago. He goes, I'm going to eventually find a way to play it's like pianos on a note. I want you to feel this boom and you hit this point and you laugh this, then you cry this when you get scared. And a good storyteller knows how to trigger all those elements. But if you as a storyteller understand the rules of what I think a lot of times screenwriters specifically and storytellers in general, we all look at story from the story's point of view. We rarely look at it from the audience's point of view in the sense of how to trigger the audience. It's generally more of a, sometimes it's ego related, meaning it's like, it's my story. I'm going to tell this story, but you never, you know, it's rare to finally think about like, well, how is the audience member going to react to this, or how is the audience member going to react to that? It's not something that's trained in Hollywood. It's at least not to my understanding.
No, but I think that's because we just didn't know for such a long time. I mean, the science that's in the book is mostly very recent science from the last sort of 10, 20 years, and especially the evolutionary stuff about moral outrage and status play, how do you get people to empathize with an anti-hero like Tony Soprano or Humbert? We just didn't know that until we understood gossip, you know, and how gossip works and why gossip works. So all these kind of previous people that have attempted to kind of tease out the secrets of storytelling, they just didn't have. I mean, I'm just lucky that I've had these tools at my disposal because I happen to be alive now rather than 30 years ago.
Well, I mean,
it gives us a whole new toolkit, you know, all this psychology.
Right. So if you look at like a character like Walter White from Breaking Bad, who's an anti-hero.
Yeah.
There is moments when anytime I'm looking at an anti-hero, like I'm right now in the middle of watching, I'm not sure if you know the show, Sons of Anarchy.
I haven't seen that.
Yeah. It's a motorcycle gang here. And the way those characters have changed. Right now, we're finding it a place where the main characters are – they have no moral code anymore. They're losing their moral code. Walter White lost his moral code along the way.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anytime you look at an anti-hero, there's always moments that he does or she does something morally correct that holds you on just a second longer before you just say this guy or this girl has to go. And towards the end, Walter White, even in the last episode, spoiler alert, is, you know, he still cared about Pinkman.
Exactly. And that's the thing. I think he's another great example of the you know, evil of the tribal emotions, you know, because at the beginning of that, the screenwriters go to great lengths to get us to empathize with him.
Oh.
He's low status. He's a teacher. He loves his job. He loves his wife. He's pregnant. Broke. He loves his son. He thinks he's going to die. And selfless. He's working in a spare time in a car wash to raise some more money.
He has a handicapped. You know, he has a handicapped son.
He's doing it all right. For the family so he could die. So they do all of those things which subconsciously make us love him. We root for him. And these are such powerful emotions, and they're so embedded in us that even when he's literally dissolving the bodies of his enemies in bars of acid, we're still rooting for him because he began as his underdog. And the other thing that you often find with anti-heroes, whether it's Tony Soprano or Humbert or Walter White, is, you know, they're partly quite low status. So Tony Soprano wasn't John Gotti. He was in this, I think it was the Staten Island mob or the New Jersey mob. He was in a crap mob. You know,
he was a low level mob. He wasn't Gotti.
He was surrounded and what they are, they're usually surrounded by much worse characters. So Tony Soprano in the first episode, Uncle Junior and his mum were both plotting against him. He was trying to, you know, he was doing all these quite nice things. He had this kind of anxiety attack when he saw some ducks. They're very sensitive, you know.
There's
loads of reasons for us to like him because he's very low status. And it's the same as Humbert in Alita. I mean, how do you get the reader to care about a paedophile? Well, you just put a much worse paedophile in the story and have him kill him. So, again, in the book, I talk about Lolita in a lot. So that's not the only thing that happens. But when you actually sort of, you know, really interrogate what the what Nabokov did with the Lolita and Humbert from the perspective of the psychology, there are so many little things he's done to manipulate us to care about Humbert. And it's all about making him low status, making him selfless. He doesn't do the really bad things. There's one of the kind of most egregious parts of that plot was that the leader's mum had to die in order to get his hands on the leader. But rather than have Humbert kill her, she was just randomly run over in the street. And it's like, oh, come on, that's so bad. But he couldn't have Humbert kill her because then you just lose.
You lose her.
So he's constantly thinking about, you know, what you were just saying. He's constantly thinking about how the audience is feeling, and he manages it beautifully. I mean, Jesus, to get you to care about a paedophile is quite an extraordinary feat.
Yeah, exactly. And towards the end, even as Walter White was coming to his end, I still kind of cared about him.
We do, yeah.
It's
course.
So
yeah.
Weird, and she's like, "This guy's a monster. He's a monster, but he's like he's kind of a good monster." It was just such an amazing transformation.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to ask you a couple questions I ask all my guests. What are three screenplays or three movies that every screenwriter should study?
Oh my god, that's a really good question. I mean, I'm going to show my kind of era now. Because they're all from the same era, but like I love Doubt.
Doubt. That's so good.
Just extraordinary. I was once teaching a class, and I had somebody in the class who said she knew the person who wrote that, and she said even he didn't. So if any of the people watching don't know Doubt, it's based around a Catholic priest, and you're never the doubt is he a paedophile? Paedophile again? Is he a paedophile or not? And even the guy who wrote the screenplay didn't know. He hadn't decided. So it's a really amazing, fantastic screenplay about doubt about that. I love American Beauty because American Beauty is another example of a story which is relentless in its plot, but also really moving, really deep. Incredible characters. So that would be my second one. And what other screenplay would I say is essential? would say Dow, American Beauty, and let's say Magnolia, because I think that's another one, another Philip Seymour Hoffman one. That, you know, it's another one which really, that was such a great period, you know, the kind of late 90s, 2000s, for really amazing American film that didn't compromise in terms of watchability, but was really, it was elevated to the level of art, I think.
Yeah, it was. I think it started with the early 90s with the Sundance crowd of filmmakers, which a lot of those guys came in and made those films. But then the studio started giving them money and a little juice behind them. And that's how, like, American Beauty and Magnolia and those kind of films were made. Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in your business or in life?
In my business, it's probably more interesting, brevity. You know, a lot of my books used to be quite long. And I don't know if you know, there's an English writer called John Ronson who does screenwriting too, actually. But I interviewed him when I was a young, you know, my early 20s. He was a big hero of mine. And as I was leaving his house, I said to him, "John, have you got just one bit of advice for me?" He said, "Yeah, brevity." And I thought, that's a shit bit of advice, brevity. You know, it's rubbish. But it took me like 20 years to work out that, yeah, it really matters. It really matters. And actually, really great writing is that, you know, clarity is concise, but packed with meaning, you know. So that's the difficult stuff. It's easy to write a 120,000 word book on the science of storytelling. It's much harder to write an 80,000 or a 60,000 word book on the science of storytelling. But if you crack the brevity, you'll get much bigger audience, you know.
Yeah.
So that's the creative lesson. The personality is that brevity is really hard, but really important.
I always used to be told, like, when I asked some of my early, when I was early on, I'm like, what advice you gave me? They go, patience. And I'm like, oh, that's crap. Patience. Yeah. That is a crap. Patience. What's bullshit? That's crap. No. Yeah. And now when people ask me, what are you doing? I'm like, patience, man. Just patience. Exactly. It's such a long road. You don't understand. Yeah. But you can't understand. When you're 20, you don't understand patience.
And when you're 20, you don't understand brevity. You think, oh, I'm an artist. All my amazing ideas.
I'm the best.
Tire of this.
Who could possibly tire of my genius?
Yes.
who? Yeah. I mean, I'll just, you know, I'll wax
a. When you're 40, you're like, shut up.
Just shut your hole and get to the point. I've got Games of Thrones to go watch. I don't have time for you, sir.
Yeah, exactly.
Where can people find you and your books and more about what you do?
Willstore.com, WILLSTORR.com. And I tweet at WStore, at WSTORR. On YouTube, if you just Google my name on YouTube, there's free kind of 5 videos of introduction to science of storytelling with some sort of basic ideas and some sort of good takeaway kind of tips. So if any of you are interested in the stuff I've been talking about, hit YouTube, and there's 5 short films that I've made on there as a kind of starter.
Oh my God. Well, man, I like I said before, man, I could talk to you for hours about this. This has really been an amazing episode. I have probably another 20 questions easily that we could keep talking about, but I'm going to take your advice. Brevity, sir. Brevity. So, thank you again so much for coming on the show and helping us.
Thank you so much.
I want to thank Will for coming on the show and dropping those knowledge bombs today. I told you guys this would be a really, really interesting and fascinating conversation. And I think we held up our part of the bargain, because Will made me think about story in a completely different way and just coming at it from the brain's point of view, which is really, really a powerful thing. I recommend you buy his book and read it ASAP. It's available everywhere on Audible, on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and so on. If you want to get links to the book and anything else we spoke about in this episode, including his amazing TED Talk, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/083. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing, no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.